Good morning, everybody. I'm so honored to follow on Kay's inspiring presentation and to chair this panel. It's really exciting for me to sit with these people, and we're going to go in the order that's listed on the schedule. There are four speakers instead of five because the fifth speaker will give a lunch plenary tomorrow. So without further ado, start with Robert Chavez to my right. He's perhaps our youngest attendee participant, 19 years old from both the Anque Owingue, is that Spanish? Yeah, and Santa Clara Pueblos. Yay. Youth coordinator for Honor Our Pueblo Existence and Think Outside the Bomb, TOTB, and a member of Tewa Women United's environmental justice group. Growing up around strong anti-nuclear mentors, let's think of all of us older ones as being able to fill that role. He began his learning and activism around nuclear issues at a very, very early age. For the past 12 years, he's been educating peer community members about the environmental and health risks of working at or living in close proximity to Los Alamos National Laboratory. Traveling speaker in the 2010 National TOTB Tour, he is passionate about educating students in New Mexico so that they may make informed decisions before pursuing work at Los Alamos National Laboratory. And I want to remind everyone that each participant has come with an action plan, a request, and I'm hoping that each one of you will end your presentations with what you want all of us to be doing. Thank you. Okay, Bob.
Good morning, everybody. How are you guys doing today? Wonderful to be here. I just want to thank every single one of you guys for being out here. I really learned a lot from over the years traveling and talking about these issues. Learned a lot from my grandmother. Learned a lot from her friends and her mentors as well. And I'm truly blessed of all the things that I've been able to see, of all the things that I've been able to learn over these past 12 years. Like I said, I'm a 19-year-old from the Pueblos Oque Owingue in San Juan. It's a pueblo in northern New Mexico. Our tribe has been in the area that it's been for thousands and thousands of years, near the Los Alamos National Laboratories. And, you know, the cultural significance of living in this area near the labs is just, you know, so great. As far back as I can remember, you know, living... That's what I know. You know, even my grandmother, my great-grandmother, 70 years of these laboratories being there, that's pretty much what we've been accustomed to. You know, I want to start out with talking about the youth. I think the youth are the most important thing right now. The education of these youth, they're the future leaders. They're the ones who are going to hold the positions of power pretty soon. You know, sometimes we take for granted the little things in life. You know, being able to go to the sink, turn on the water, to take a drink of water, to breathe, to take that bit of fresh air, to be able to go to your neighbor and to greet your neighbor with a smile. We take all these little things for granted. In my community, there is a lot of issues. Some people go hungry at night. There is a really big drug issue in my community. Right next door, we have the richest county in the United States of America, the most millionaires per capita in the United States of America. And in my community, people struggle. How are we going to get the next meal? How are we going to send our children to school? Well, there's not very many options. The number one provider of jobs in my community, Los Alamos National Laboratories. The number two provider of jobs in my community, Walmart. Exactly. So see, growing up, all my life, you know, I see people, my uncles and my aunties, you know, working at the laboratories, you know, sure, they're driving nice cars and making $20, $30 an hour, but that's the bottom of the list, you know. They're going, they're doing the work, they're going and cleaning this waste, they're moving this waste. They're having to sacrifice their lives in order to support their families. And you have other people working 2-3 jobs just to support their families. I mean, it's life. Life is so, so short. Life is so precious. We don't deserve it. We don't deserve all this cancer that's going around. You know, I have a friend, you know, her brother, 21 years old, security guard at Los Alamos, passed away to acute radiation exposure. 21 years old. 21 years old. It's amazing how many people overlook these little things, overlook how precious each and every one of us is, each and every mind, everybody out there. That's why we have to educate, we have to teach these people, we got to teach these children, we got to go into the schools and tell them. Like I said, my community, the labs have been in my community for almost 70 years. When I go to schools, when I do presentations, I ask, how many people, you know, have family members working at the labs? You know, 95, 96, 97% of the people raise their hands. And when I ask, do you know what they do up there? Not a single hand. It's amazing. My grandmother, almost 90 years old. Her son works there. You know, she's basically been there as long as she could remember. And she still doesn't have a clue what's going on. Has no idea. Has no idea that in our culture or homeland, this threat exists. It could all be taken away in an instant. You know, my people have been there for thousands and thousands of years. I mean, where would we go if something was to go wrong? Where would we go? That's our homeland. That place is special to me. Inside, in my heart, it's where I'm from. It's who I am. And it's my duty in life to protect that. To stand up and say and do what's right. Because that's not right. I'm sure it provides jobs. Sure, they do some good things in Los Alamos, but the majority of their work is nuclear weapons, plutonium. I say that one more time. I get chills every time I hear that word, plutonium. You got one particle of plutonium. It's considered potentially hazardous to the human health. That particle's 1/10 the size of the thickness of the human hair. Tiny, tiny little particles. They have 5,000 pounds of it, 2.5 metric tons sitting in a vault, 20 miles away from where I lie my head down to rest every night. And it's scary. It scares me because not everybody knows. People go on with their daily lives like, whatever, it's just a part of our daily lives. It's not a part of our daily lives. It shouldn't be a part of our daily lives. It shouldn't. We should have options. We should have the ability to go and support our families without having to make that ultimate sacrifice. It should be available to all of us. I have a feeling that a day will come when we could stand together and rise up. The children of our community to look to one another and realize the truth that has been so long overlooked all these years, the truth of life, because that's the bottom line. That's the bottom line. Life, the ability to wake up in the morning, to open your eyes, to get up, and to see the world, to enjoy this world. We only got one world. I said the water, the air, everything around us. We got to protect that. And that's why I'm here today. Thank you so much.
A shame. Why shouldn't everyone in the world have heard what Bob had to say? But please do tweet and tell people about what you hear today, okay? Because the structures are so much the same here in Fukushima. Okay, our next speaker is Kristen Iverson. She's the author of a really wonderful book. I can say that because I'm two-thirds through. And I also had to, and it's also a page-turner. I had to skip to the end, too, because I knew I wasn't going to finish it before I met her. The author of Full Body Burden, It's Being Sold Outside, Growing Up in the Nuclear Shadow of Rocky Flats, that's Colorado. She grew up in Arvada, Colorado, near the Rocky Flats Nuclear Weaponry Facility and received a PhD in English from the University of Denver. She's published in multiple places. She's an associate professor at the University of Memphis, where she directs the MFA program in creative writing. Yay for the arts and fighting this deadly technology. Kristen?
Okay, I think someone needs to lift that little black. Yes, okay. thank you so much for having me here today. I'm delighted to be here. My story, there are so many similarities between our stories, and it's really an honor and a privilege to be here. 10 years of my life went into the research and writing of Full Body Burden, growing up in the nuclear shadow of Rocky Flats. I grew up next to a secret weapons facility, and later I worked at the plant myself. What I'm going to do today, as was mentioned earlier, there are books in the back, and I hope you will buy a book. What I wanted to do with the book was write it in a novelistic fashion. I wanted it to read like a novel, but everything in the book is true. It's very heavily footnoted and very heavily fact-checked. When this book was published this summer, I had a discussion with my publisher and my agent, and we came to the decision to not include photographs or charts or contamination maps or anything like that in the book, because they wanted readers to be able to experience the book like a novel, really, to get really drawn into it. And so we decided not to include photographs and all these sorts of things. So what I'm going to do in the next 10 minutes or so is show you some of the things that were not included in the book in terms of the photos and the pictures. So I'm going to tell you the story of what happened to me and my family and what happened at Rocky Flats. And I'm going to go through these slides rather quickly. Much of this information is available on my website and also on my author Facebook page. So if you see something, a chart or something like that you'd like more information about, you can contact me and let me know. This is the story of Rocky Flats and my community.
I pointed at that little black thing on this podium. It should work there.
There. Okay, thank you. Hey, I'm an English major. You have to bear with me. Okay, the title of the book, Body Burning, comes from the amount, all of you know this term, the amount of radioactive material present in a human body which acts as an internal and ongoing source of radiation. With my book, I wanted to put a human face on what I felt to be a very inhumane story. And the story begins with my family when they first moved to Colorado. I come from Scandinavian farm families in Iowa and Minnesota, and my parents moved to Colorado where they thought they could start a new life, and this is my father and me right after I was born, right after we moved out to Colorado. When my two sisters were, that's me in the middle, when my two sisters were born, we moved out to a new subdivision in Arvada, Colorado, near Rocky Flats, and our house was about 7 miles from the facility, although we had no idea at the time. When my two sisters were born and then my brother, my father's law practice was doing a little bit better, and they decided to move into a new house in a new subdivision out by Rocky Flats, and at that point we were about 2.5-3 miles from the plant. Again, we had no idea. This is a picture of me at our first house right before we moved. And I just show this because it's kind of neat. If you look closely, I didn't notice this until the book actually came out. But my parents, my family has been incredibly supportive of this book. It was a very difficult book to write from a personal standpoint as well as all the research involved. And my family was very, very supportive. And in this photo, you can see my mother sitting right behind me. And that's my father's shadow on the ground. So it's kind of a neat thing. There was a secret in our neighborhood. This plant is located just between Boulder and Denver. And it's about 8-9 miles from Boulder and about 11 miles from Denver. The Rocky Flats Nuclear Weapons Plant began secret operations in 1952. It was owned by the Atomic Energy Commission, now, of course, the Department of Energy, and it was operated by Dow Chemical. This is a shot of the actual plutonium production facility. We could see the water tower from our back porch. Our house was a little further out than this, so we could see the water tower, and that was about it. Most of the buildings, there were eventually more than 800 buildings at Rocky Flats. Some of them were partially or fully underground. You couldn't see anything from the road. Here's an aerial view of Rocky Flats. You can see how large the facility is. My house. Just to give you an idea of perspective, we didn't know it was there. We didn't know it was produced at Rocky Flats. When I was a kid, it was operated by Dow Chemical. The rumor in my neighborhood was that they were making household cleaning supplies. My mother thought they were making scrubbing bubbles. They weren't making scrubbing bubbles. From 1952 to 1989, Rocky Flats produced more than 70,000 plutonium pits or triggers for nuclear weapons at a cost of $45 million apiece. Each trigger, as you know, contains enough breathable particles of plutonium to kill every person on Earth. Workers weren't allowed to talk about their work, even to their own families. When I began my formal research for this project, I was stunned to discover how many different things, people believed that Rocky Flats produced. We thought they were making scrubbing bubbles. Other people thought they were making glass doorknobs or fertilizer. You know, there were all sorts of rumors in the neighborhood. And part of that was because there was intentional misrepresentation on the part of the plant by Dow Chemical and Rockwell. And there's no doubt of that. But it's also when you have workers in a facility where they can't talk about what they do and a policy of containment where workers in one area are not allowed to know what workers in another area are doing. When people go home to have suppers with their family at night, with their families, they will sometimes make things up. So the workers made things up, too, to tell their kids, well, you know, dad's just making, you know, doorknobs or whatever. So it was incredible how many rumors there were about what actually happened at the plant. And again, we didn't know. Rocky Flats produced plutonium triggers, but its biggest output was toxic and radioactive waste. Hanford supplied the plutonium for Rocky Flats, and Oak Ridge supplied the enriched uranium. The triggers themselves were then sent on to Pantex, where they were encased in conventional explosives. One of the things that workers said when out at the plant, certainly when I worked out at the plant, was this idea that, well, we're not really making the bomb itself. Of course, we were. But people would justify it or rationalize it to themselves sometimes by saying, well, it's going someplace else to be encased in a conventional explosives. We're not the one who's pulling the trigger. We're not the one who's actually doing the bomb work. We're just messing around with plutonium triggers. Here's a photo of a glove box at Rocky Flats. And as you can see, workers would put their arms and hands into lead-lined gloves and look through a Benelux plastic shielding window. Here's another photo of a glove box line at Rocky Flats, and you can see how these boxes are linked. Plutonium, as I'm sure you know, is highly flammable. There were many, many fires at Rocky Flats. Over the course of almost 40 years, there were more than 200 fires at Rocky Flats, two big ones that I'm going to talk about very briefly. But part of the reason that why the fires were such a problem is that not only is it difficult to put out a plutonium fire, you can't use water on plutonium without risking a criticality. But it travels very quickly through these glove box lines, and if something sparks and moves through the lines, it races through the entire line very quickly. Here's another shot. This is one of my favorite shots of a glove box. This is a repacking glove box. It's kind of eerie. There were many, many problems with storage at Rocky Flats. We had more waste, particularly plutonium waste, than we knew what to do with. There are a number of stories that I talk about in the book. There was a red box. There were box cars, for example, filled with waste when Idaho didn't want it and Nevada didn't want it, and we didn't know where to send it. Sometimes there would be box cars that would travel around the country full of radioactive waste, not unlike the barge in New York, you know, remember that went up and down the coastline. But waste was a huge problem at Rocky Flats, where to store it, what to do with it. We were at our limit. When I worked out at Rocky Flats, I was working next to more than 14 tons of plutonium, and I didn't know. Some of it was stored inside, as you can see here. Here's another shot of the glove box line. And the interesting thing about this shot is production was always emphasized over safety at Rocky Flats, and sometimes things would get moved around, and alarm systems would be moved aside, or it was very, very crowded. And again, that was another reason why there were such problems with fires out there and worker safety. Dow Chemical and Rockwell maintained from the very beginning that there was nothing dangerous going on at Rocky Flats, that they were not making bombs, they were not making anything that was dangerous to the public in any way. One of the things that I talk about in my book was, and I want to emphasize, there's nothing new in my book that hasn't been written or published somewhere else. It's just that I'm bringing it all together in a different kind of way. One thing that happened was... it turned out that the Denver Post was accepting payments from Rockwell to print positive stories about Rocky Flats for years. And ironically, it was a Denver Post reporter 20 years later who uncovered that information. But again, we had no idea what was going on out there. There was no warning, no evacuation or any information anytime there was a release, routine or otherwise, or a fire. This is a photograph of the incinerator at Building 771, which was the plutonium processing building. This particular incinerator routinely released plutonium and other contaminants into the atmosphere, and it was one of the issues that led to the FBI raid in 1989 on Rocky Flats. I believe it's the only time in the history of our country that two government agencies, the FBI and the EPA, have raided another, the Department of Energy. And I could say much about that, but I don't have the time. But this is one of the reasons that raid happened. Another was I'll just mention briefly, Pondcrete, which was an attempt on the part of Rocky Flats to mix plutonium with concrete. And they created thousands of these blocks that were the size of small refrigerators. And workers at the plant eventually called it the jelly factory because it never hardened, and it was like Jello, and you could stick your thumb into this stuff. And it was stored outside, and a lot of that stuff seeped into the environment. So Pondcrete was another reason why we had this secret FBI raid. This is a very quick shot of known waste and burial sites at Rocky Flats. These two creeks, one of them, Walnut Creek, flows down into Stanley Lake. My house is right on the edge of Stanley Lake there. The interesting thing here is known waste implies unknown waste. Is there unknown waste? Yes, there is. The site has never been fully characterized. This is a shot of an infinity room. Rooms on site where something happened, something had occurred in a short period of time, a long period of time, where the room was so profoundly contaminated that it was just completely sealed. This particular room has a jackhammer inside of it from the 1950s, and it was closed forever. I mentioned the problem of waste. Unknown to the public, more than 5,000 barrels stood out in the open for more than 11 years. My house is kind of right over here on the side. Boulder's up here, Denver's over there. What happened with these barrels? They rusted out. Radioactive toxic material leaked into the soil, contaminated groundwater, and was carried off-site. The public was not informed. There were two big fires at Rocky Flats, one in 1957, the year before I was born, that was so big that it burned out all of the, not just all the filters, 620 filters, but also all of the measuring equipment. Again, there was no warning or information available to the public. The second big fire was in 1969, the year after my family The year that my family moved out to our new house, that was even closer. Here, a worker is pointing to the box where the 1957 fire started. Here you can see a shot of the burned-out filters. Plutonium was detected in a school playground 12 miles away, and later plutonium from these fires and from the barrels was detected as far as 30 miles away. So essentially, there's a 30-mile radius that extends well into the Metro Denver area of land that was contaminated by Rocky Flats. Now I want to return briefly to my family story. Again, I wanted to put a human face on a kind of inhumane story. This is our Christmas photo right after we moved out to the plant. This is the first love of my life. And I wanted to show this because some of you have read the book and everyone is, what happened to Tonka? Here's a picture of Tonka. We often went swimming in Stanley Lake with our horses and our dogs, and that lake has plutonium in the sediment. It's another shot of Tonka. Well, horses get old. But, you know, I just want to say, 3 minutes. Okay, I'm going to go through real quick here to the rest of them. But I just say one thing. Animals are very important in the book, and it's in the animals that we first see the effects of plutonium. Strontium was detected in the bones of horses right down the road from my house. You can see how open and windswept this land is. This is all housing development now. This is the path of the 1969 fire and the 1957 fire over our house and over the Metro Denver area. These are areas of contamination around Rocky Flats. My house is right near Stanley Lake there in the third level. As I said, it was in animals that we began to see plutonium and other evidence. This is a Department of Energy memo that talks about radioactive rabbits in the area. Note that this is dated 1961. We didn't discover it. We didn't find out about this until the 1990s. There are great stories in the book about activism out at Rocky Flats. I don't have time to go into it today, so I'm just going to flip through some of these photos. It's Allen Ginsberg. Some of you may know Dr. Leroy Moore. Or Jackie Brever, one of the whistleblowers out at the plant that helped, her work helped lead to the raid. Wes McKinley, foreman of the runaway grand jury. It's a great story. This is me with my two boys when I went to work at the plant. This is what the plant looked like when I went to work out there. Workers at the plant. I had no idea what was going on at Rocky Flats. One night I came home, and there was a Nightline expose on television, and they were interviewing people that I worked with, and that was the first time that I heard exactly what was going on and knew that I was working in a very dangerous area. I'll end with two quick slides. One is, when I was working at Rocky Flats, I kept coming across this acronym for MUF. I was, MUF? What's MUF? It stands for Missing Unaccounted For Plutonium. Over the course of almost 40 years, Rocky Flats misplaced or lost more than 3,000 pounds of plutonium. Many workers became ill. This is Charlie Wolf, one of the managers I work with. These people have, he's since passed away. You may be aware of Charlie Wolf legislation that we're trying to, the Charlie Wolf Act that we're trying to get through. This is a young woman right down the road from me, who's had several brain tumors. I don't have time to talk about the cleanup, but suffice to say that it is a very controversial cleanup. A lot of people call it a cover-up rather than a cleanup. And what are we doing right now? We are the Rocky Flats National Wildlife Refuge. Although 1,300 acres are so profoundly contaminated, they can never be open to the public. The rest of the site, 4,000 acres, is slated to open for public recreation, hiking, and biking. Even though there are very controversial levels of contamination, and we are building new houses on contaminated land right next to Rocky Flats, and these people who buy these houses are not informed that the land is contaminated. These are the three things, and I'll end here. I know I've pushed my time. These are the things that we need to do most immediately. I have information if anyone would like to help us with this. Stop the construction of homes and highways going through contaminated land. Prevent the wildlife refuge from opening to the public. That's my number one thing. And halt Department of Interior plans for Rocky Mountain Greenway Project to create trails, hiking trails through the Rocky Flats land. So thank you so much for your patience.